Good afternoon. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. Phil Connor is here. How you doing, Phil?
Yes, good afternoon, Phil. I'm doing well, thanks.
We're going to be talking to the editor of New African. His name is Mr. Nkoma, Bafour Nkoma. He has recently traveled to an embattled area in terms of political struggles between West and North and South, I guess you could say, to Zimbabwe. He had an interview with Robert Mugabe. He also spoke to the president of Tanzania. And you can find it in the May issue of the New African. Very interesting. It's probably the best English language publication I can think of if you want to know what is going on in Africa today, and one which reflects the point of view, you might say, I'm going to guess at this, but I would call him Nkrumahist, one who adheres to the original program of liberating Africa from the thralls of colonialism. And naturally, he would be at that place where people were raising hob with Mr. Mugabe. And we'd say on this show very often, we'd like to hear more from it was what people have to say for themselves, as opposed to reading about somebody who travels from Toronto and writes to the Globe and Mail and tells us all about them, but they are pretty much muzzled. And the South Africa Development Council, I believe it's what the initials SADC stand for, gave a real shock to London and Washington because there had been an incident, and we're going to ask Mr. Nkoma about it. There had been an incident in Zimbabwe where the leader of the opposition had been beaten up at a demonstration. And shortly after that, there was a great hue and cry, front pages all over London and New York and subsidiaries like Toronto, and saying that obviously Mugabe had to go. And Mugabe went off to attend the meeting of the Southern Africa Development Council, and it was said that he was going to be taken care of there. They were going to put him in his place. And so the meeting ended, and they said, well, Mr. what did you decide? And they said, well, Britain ought to pay Zimbabwe the money that they owe them. And Mr. Mugabe is the president of Zimbabwe. So that was the upshot of that. And the West was flabbergasted. They couldn't believe what had happened. We haven't yet got Mr. Nkoma, so I wanted to say, but while we're waiting on that point, that we later we will be talking to Jordi Palau Ragnani. Mr. Ragnani's in Spain, and he is one of the conveners. He is a lawyer there. He's one of the conveners of an organization trying to bring truth and reconciliation to those who've been struggling with one another in the Great Lakes regions of Africa. And that's where Cynthia McKinney was attending a conference. We want to hear about that conference. Incidentally, we have also had communications with Cynthia McKinney, and we do anticipate she will be on the Taylor Report probably as early as next Monday, we hope, but certainly soon. That's confirmed. And when we will update you, because I know there's a great interest here in the that very brave congresswoman, former congresswoman, served two terms in U.S. Congress, and she did what a congressperson should do, which is speak truth to power and challenge the generals and challenge the Pentagon and challenge Wolfowitz, and good for her, and we want to hear more about her. And just after 5:30 today, we expect to be talking to Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti is coming to Toronto. He's going to be at 55 Gould Street, 7 o'clock Sunday. And you can get tickets for that at a different book list at 746 Bathurst, or you can call CKLN 416-979-5251, extension 2373. Well, not to try to read things, small things without their glasses. I'm going to make sure I get the extension right. You asked, by the way, for Daniel Vandervoort, and it's 2373 is the extension. It's CKLN 416-979-5251 for tickets to the talk by Michael Parenti. The subject will be race, gender, and class. He has a new book, The Culture Struggle, and we'll be talking to him about both things today. I've been told that it's going to be a few moments, so I think we're going to take a quick break, and maybe we might juggle and see if we can get Mr. Ragnoni use up the time that way. So we'll be right back. Taylor Report, CIUT, and 89.5 FM. By the way, write to us at taylor@ciut.fm, and you can check out our website, taylor-report.com. And while we are trying to reach Jordi Palou Ragnoni, we will speak to Philip Conlon. Phil Conlon has an issue was to raise about the deaths of Haitians in the Caribbean and why it's not regarded as some kind of crime.
Besides the legalities of it, which are horrible enough, I mean, it's the lack of outrage and the lack of comment. But these were a boatload of Haitian migrants doing not much differently what our European ancestors did, which was getting on boats and going someplace where they could earn a living. And they were trying to land on the Turks and Caicos Islands, which, as it turns out from my research, is a country that, or a little two islands, that relies on Haitian labor. There's lots of Haitians living there, building the place up and working the place. And a police launch, evidently, according to the reports and according to what the survivors say, met them in the water and rammed their boat until it overturned. And the bodies of at least 60 migrants have washed up so far, many of them partially eaten by sharks. Now, I'd like to talk to some of our lawyer friends and know what the law of the sea is on this sort of thing, but my understanding is people on the water are supposed to be given succor, not supposed to be deliberately sunk.
You know? Yes. And by the way, I hope we stay with that because this is where you say, why doesn't somebody charge those who caused them to be lost at sea?
Well, that would be the British authorities because that's British island.
British island, but was it American or British ships, boats that prevented them from...
Well, there were police launches of the Turks and Caicos Islands.
And so that so makes, were British.
That's British. Yes.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, there's a long list of crimes that we could look ask the British about, I guess. Mm. And we'll do that. Phil, thanks very much. And I think we are joined now by Jordi Palou. Ragnoni, are you there? Jordi?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, it's good to hear you. How are you?
Very well. Good evening for you.
You have an organization devoted to, if I understand it, to bring peace and reconciliation, or is it, I'm sorry, truth and reconciliation to the Great Lakes region, which I assume means Burundi, Rwanda, East Congo, Uganda.
Actually, Rwanda and East Congo.
And what is your work? What have you been, and you just had a conference. Can you tell us about it?
Yes, the International Forum for Truth and Justice in the Great Lakes region, we would say we have two main projects. One is end impunity and justice, especially in Rwanda and Congo. And then we have a project of a dialogue between especially Hutus and Tutsis in Rwanda. So we understand that both steps are necessary to go forward in the Great Lakes region.
Mm-hmm. You yourself, you're based in Spain. You're a lawyer, And I know that there's one of the subjects that's come up is there have been, I think it was Spanish priests who died in Rwanda after the seizure of power in 1994 by the present government, the RPF. Is that right? Hello?
Religious people, but also members of NGOs. There were one priest in 94, and then four Marist brothers in 96 in eastern part of Congo. And then three doctors, members of Doctors of the World Organization in northern part of Rwanda, and then one priest in 2000 in Rwanda. So these nine special Spaniards victims in Rwanda and Eastern Congo gave us a little bit the opportunity to inquire about these killings, but also to try to understand what was going on in Rwanda and Eastern Congo between 90, the year 90 and 2002. And that's one of our main goals of our legal action is to investigate not only the killings of the Spanish people, but also Rwandese.
Now that we have a permanent tribunal, do you think, for example, a United Nations established a permanent tribunal at The Hague? Is that a place that you could go with this case? I mean, you've gone into Spanish courts.
I have to say that I'm personally lawyer also before the International Criminal Court in The Hague, but this case is not possible to present it before The Hague because all crimes are committed between 90 and 2002. That's why we finished in 2002. Because
before the tribunal was established.
Exactly. July 2002 is the first moment that facts can be presented before the court in The Hague.
Mm-hmm. And your main issue, I mean, and I certainly sympathize with this. This is something that, and many lawyers and actually people for the prosecution at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda underline this subject, and it was brought first by Louise Arbour, the Canadian prosecutor, was that the idea was to end impunity. That is, you know, that people could commit offenses and because of their association with state power or a particular ethnic group could escape punishment. However, we have it's understood so far that no one from the ethnic group which prevailed in the fighting in 1994 and certainly no one from the political organization called the RPF has been charged with anything.
That's correct. That's the main problem, I think, for the international community to see how is the Arusha tribunal going on. It's like 250 to 300 million dollars every year since it was established, and since that moment, just a few, which are absolutely probably criminals, but we have to say they're. There were criminals that killed thousands of people in each ethnic group, we would say. And, of course, this probably was the main reason why Carla Del Ponte, also the prosecutor in Arusha, chief prosecutor in Arusha, was put it off her charge because she presented some evidences of FPR responsibles before Arusha tribunal. So we really don't understand why this situation is still going on in that direction.
Mm. Yes,
and that's why also we of course consider that our legal action in Spain could in a way offer some equity in that justice system, international system.
Yeah. Now, you had one of the prominent individuals who came there to Spain and spoke was Cynthia McKinney, former congresswoman from Georgia. What was her role? What did she contribute?
Yes, I have to say that she is one of the persons who also presented the law, so it's one of the plaintiffs, but she's not the only one that she came here. She was in Spain several days ago, and as much as probably you know, she was sent by Clinton administration and personally by Clinton because I know now and judge know right now that she was in an official delegation with Bill Richardson in she will explain you that probably more deeply.
Yes, we're looking forward to talking to her soon. Yeah.
But she was before 97 in 96 with Kabila, sharing, of course, a lot of things. She's an African-American congresswoman at that moment. And so she shared many things with Kabila while the things were being prepared to take power and to put off Mobutu's power. So, and the main thing that probably she shared with Judge was what she realized from in that moment, in that period, that was being organized, especially by multinationals, American multinationals, corporations, mining corporations, that were in a way organizing the conflict. They were sharing or exchanging weapons, arms, and financial support to have mining concessions in eastern part of Congo. So this probably is the most important link between the concrete crimes that were committed in eastern part of Congo, especially against Hutu refugees who were in camps, and civil Congolese civil population.
They were in United Nations camps.
And the interest of these corporations of mining.
Well, that's very dramatic material. So that was like a part of an affidavit she made in presenting a case, right? She actually is, by your account, is a witness to something.
Exactly. She's a witness. And, of course, there are so many details that she knew personally because she was in the Great Lakes region, not only with Kabila, but also with Kagame and all... and many other leaders, military leaders in the area, and the main vision that she shared and she witnesses, she was witnessing in that period, was this realization that she was having there this kind of facts in front of her, so she couldn't realize little by little what was going on, what was the real politics of the U.S. State Department, government, and so on.
Yeah. You know, it's a dramatic story. Of course, her political career has been very dramatic. She's a very courageous individual.
Yes, as an African American congresswoman, I've been there, and I've known a little bit her community, and she is really considered a very courageous woman, following the steps of Martin Luther King Jr. And in a way, she was continuing this service for community. Martin Luther King was fighting for civil rights in his community and his country. And probably Cynthia McKinney is doing the same outside with the African countries.
Yes. Well, I agree with you, and I think it's an important story. Jordy, we thank you very much. We want to get back to you again soon. We're sorry that today we don't have as much time, but let us talk soon about your conference, and also we want to make sure our listeners will know how to follow the work of your organization.
Thank you, Phil, for the time and for the possibility to be with you.
Good. Thank you. Bye-bye. And that was Jordy Palou Ragnoni. He is in Spain. He is a lawyer. He has been concerned about issues and has a broad committee in Spain, one member of which is a Nobel Prize winner. I'm sorry to tell you, I don't know the name offhand. But I do know that about the work, and I know that Cynthia McKinney thinks very highly of that organization and of Mr. Ragnoni. We're going to follow this, we hope, as early as next week by talking to Cynthia McKinney herself. At any rate, we are going to take a... Well, no, I tell you what, we'll stay with you, and we expect to have Mr. Nkomo with us soon. And, of course, a little later on, we'll be talking to Michael Parenti about his book, The Culture Struggle, and also about his upcoming talk at 55 Gould Street, 7 o'clock, Sunday, May 20, on race, gender, and class, which seems to be the topic of the day, because when I came in, I was listening to a speech being given on CIUT, you have to get it here, and by Mr. Jensen. And the title of the talk is Race, Gender, and Class. So apparently there's no copyright on that title. Mr. Nkoma, whom we hope to reach soon, is the editor of New African, and the May issue of New African has a long, interesting interview with President Mugabe. And I believe Mr. Nkoma is on the phone. Are you there, Mr. Nkoma?
Yes, I am here.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine.
You have a very exciting, a very timely issue of New African. You had an interview with two really important leaders in East Africa. Of course, Mr. Robert Mugabe, president of Zimbabwe, but you also interviewed the president of Tanzania. And this is just at the time when there had been, maybe it was going on while you were there, the meeting of Southern Africa Development Council?
Yes, I was there. Yes, I was at the meeting at a summit where the...
And that's the one where the New York Times and London Times told us that the African leaders were going to discipline Mr. Mugabe and ask him to go away.
That was wishful thinking of the highest order.
Yeah, they were flabbergasted. How could they have been so out of sync with reality?
Exactly, because they've been telling a lie, and so they were only living through the lie that they have told to themselves. Nothing of the sort was expected in Jerusalem. I was there. I was at a conference.
Yeah. And well, I saw, by the way, some of it. They came out and everyone waited breathlessly, and they said, well, what have you concluded about Mr. Mugabe? And they said, Britain ought to pay the money they owe, and Mr. Mugabe is the president of Zimbabwe.
Exactly. Yeah. There was no way they were going to say anything. I interviewed the president of Tanzania next morning after the summit, and he said, removing Mugabe was not on the agenda. What was on the agenda was the SADC leaders sitting down and thinking through a plan to help Zimbabwe, and because they know that the country was suffering from these economic sanctions that Britain, USA, and the other Western nations have imposed on Zimbabwe, and which they were going around telling lies about it. They only talk about the travel ban. The travel ban will not hurt anybody in Zimbabwe. Mugabe doesn't want to come to Europe. So, but the real thing that is hurting the economy have been these economic sanctions that they imposed since 2001 and telling lies about it.
Yes. It really resembles what we know in this hemisphere of the way the U.S. treats Cuba. And that there was a period when they had Cuba almost on its knees economically. I mean, they had no fuel, and they were having a very difficult time. I don't know if that African leaders watched that, but it seems like an analogous experience.
That is what they are actually aiming at. They want Zimbabwe to be on its knees. And even when you talk about fuel, when I last went there in 2004, no, I last went there, I think, 2 years ago, but in 2004 I was there, and Libya was giving them some fuel. And all of a sudden, Libya stopped. And it was at the time that Britain and USA were trying to rehabilitate Libya. So they asked them to stop. When I interviewed President Mugabe 2 years ago, he mentioned it. This time he also mentioned it, that even ships that are carrying fuel to Zimbabwe were intercepted on the high seas by Britain, and they were telling the crew in the ships, if you divert this fuel to another country, we are going to pay you double the amount of fuel that Zimbabwe will pay you. So these people are really I think they've gone bonkers, if you excuse my friends.
Yes, you know, bonkers is a good word for it. Or returning to their pirate roots. I mean, the British got, as in establishing themselves, had a high incidence of piracy amongst the people who were running the place, right? I mean, they behave like pirates.
And that's what they are basically doing. If you go up to a ship captain and tell him, "David, divert this petrol to Mozambique or to another country. Don't give it to Zimbabwe," when Zimbabwe has ordered for it and paid for it, and you're going to offer them more money, and the same people go preaching about corruption.
Yes. We're speaking to Bafoura Nkoma. He is the editor of New African. The May issue has a great interview with President Robert Mugabe himself. And we on this program have always wanted to know the point of view of those who are getting the most abuse in media here, particularly in Africa, since their voices are rarely heard. Now, Mr. Nkoma, can you describe the man a little bit? Well, what's it like to interview him? Is he a personable fellow or is he difficult? What's Mr. Mugabe like to talk to?
He is a personable fellow. I remember this time when I entered his office, he came over there from behind his desk and greeted me, held my hand, and said, "But you didn't bring any weapon. You didn't bring a weapon. We are still in a fight." And I said, "Your Excellency," I showed him my tape recorder, and I said, "This is my weapon." And we laughed. He's a personable fellow. He is not the Hitler that people have described him. He sits down with you, he offers you tea, you talk amicably, and no, I have had no problem at all with him. He's not the kind of person that they have painted him at all.
And how about his grasp of things? Does he know about his neighbors? Does he talk about the rest of the world? I mean, for example, when I listen to the number one leader of the Western world, Mr. Bush, I think it's a consensus agreement that he doesn't seem to really know much about the world. What is Mr. Mugabe like on that?
Mr. Mugabe is quite knowledgeable. Remember, he has 4 degrees. He, even when he was in prison, he was studying by correspondence from London University. He has a good grasp of what is happening around him. And I remember somebody who was the envoy of Charles Taylor in Liberia went to Zimbabwe, and President Mugabe told him, "The best thing is good neighborliness. You talk to your neighbors," and he said, "I have survived. We have survived in Zimbabwe because we talk to our neighbors and they have supported us." Yes, he talked to his neighbors. When I interviewed President Kikwete in Dar es Salaam, the president of Tanzania, he mentioned that as well. He said, "Yes, we talked. We talk about all these issues, and we think that this time we've been able to have a very, very frank talk, and we've discussed all the issues on the table."
Mm-hmm.
So he knows what is going on around him. He reads even the private newspapers, which are very anti him in Zimbabwe. There is another lie going around. And last 3 weeks, Charlene Hunter-Gould, the former correspondent for CNN, came to speak here, and he made the point that there is no independent voice in Zimbabwe. I was in the crowd, sitting at the back, and I was so furious that I shouted at the top of my voice and said, "You are telling a lie." Because when I was coming back this time, 3 weeks ago, I carried 18 kilos of newspapers, private newspapers, 5 of them, which are all weeklies, very, very anti-Mugabe, which is being circulated in Zimbabwe. There is another one, the Zimbabwean, which is published from abroad, printed in Ireland, sent in, and it's sold on the streets of Zimbabwe. There is another one coming from South Africa, which is sold on the streets of Zimbabwe. And yet, people are going around saying there's no independent voice in Zimbabwe. No, that's not true. And I keep telling people that this time I want to show people examples of these newspapers, how they report, the kind of headlines they write about Mugabe, and the insult they hell on him. But he reads these newspapers, and these editors are free to live in Harare and go about their normal duties.
Yes. You, by the way, have also touched on something really quite I really hope the word gets out about this, that despite the economic difficulties, mainly as a result of the basic embargo against him, his political opponents have apparently become so selfish, I guess, in their own point of view, that his political opposition is divided, and it's not him divided, they've divided against each other, and they're and in a violent way. Is that right?
It is. If you read this, our main issue, it's quite clear. The article is written by David Coulter, is the MDC MP, white MP, Washman Nkube, who used to be the Secretary General of the MDC before the split in November 2005. As an interview, they're talking about the dictatorial tendencies of Morgan Tsvangirai and why they split. This party is a party, to me, that will find it difficult to win power. Even when they were united, they couldn't. Now that they have been split into two, it is even going to be more difficult. That is why the American ambassador in Harare is trying to bring them together. When I was there, I found that they were now holding meetings together, the two sides. You know, Morgan Tsvangirai leaves one faction of the MDC, and Professor Atta Mutambara, who used to work in the USA, came down, and he is also the leader of the other faction. They didn't used to talk. The whole of 2006, they were organizing this war of attrition against each other. Now the American embassy, thanks to the ambassador there, has been able to bring them together a bit. So they are holding these so-called prayer rallies together, which is basically political rallies in another name.
Yes, I was. That was a good part of your interview. I liked that. You asked Mr. Mugabe about they're calling prayer meetings. He said, "Well, we're not against prayer meetings. That's fine. But if they're going to have political meetings, that's different."
Exactly.
You know, make up their mind.
You know, the Western media hasn't really reported about the violence organized by the MDC activists starting from end of January this year, February, which forced the government to impose a ban on rallies that were potentially going to lead into violence in specific areas of Harare, not the whole country. They said you couldn't hold a rally here, you couldn't hold a rally in that suburb. Mm-hmm. And then the MDC, just wanting some trouble, said we are going to hold it by all means. So they went to court, and the court ruled that because the government has not published in the newspapers, according to law, that these areas nobody can hold rallies.
Yes.
The MDC technically won in court. The government then published them and told the MDC, until our appeal has been heard, you can't hold the rallies. So they changed the name of this political rally into a prayer meeting where no bishop, as the president said, no pastor, no bishop, no reverend was going to speak. It was only Morgan Tsvangirai, Atta Mutambara, and this MDC people. So that is what actually happened on that day.
Yes, and you raised a very friendly kind of almost critical observation with President Mugabe. You said these embassies, they send their people to participate in these political meetings, and obviously they're intervening in your affairs. Why do you tolerate it? That's an excellent question. If any embassy did that in Canada, they would be in big trouble. There's no way those embassies could do it.
That African countries allow this Western diplomats this latitude to do whatever they want. I live in the UK, and none of our ambassadors here, none of the African ambassadors, will be able to do a quarter of what these Western ambassadors are doing in Harare. That's why I asked him that question.
Yes.
And then when he was trying to prefabricate, I asked him again, so are there any concrete sanctions that we can take against such misbehavior by diplomats? And he said, oh, we've read them the Riot Act, and if they don't behave, we'll kick them out.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's high time Africa kicked somebody out. They should kick somebody out to tell them that if the Ghanaian ambassador in USA cannot interfere in the internal affairs of USA, then the American ambassador in Accra should not be given any quota at all to make the kind of pronouncements and actions that we see in Harare.
Absolutely. We're speaking to Bafour Nkoma. He's the editor of New African. The May issue has a wonderful interview, an important interview with President Mugabe. And a last question. The Southern African states, they showed a lot of courage, by the way. I mean, it was natural in the sense that, yes, they didn't intend to remove him or try to anyway, but they will get a lot of pressure. What do you think of the prospects that they can help in this situation, and are they going to be able to stay together?
They will stay together, because if you read the interview where President Mugabe told me and I had known about it in Jerusalem at the summit, that, you know, when they arrived the previous night, they held a closed-door meeting among themselves. And it was there that President Thabo Mbeki, who has come under intense pressure from the West, just to come out and say something about Zimbabwe, it was him who said, look, what's happening in Zimbabwe? It's because the West has targeted a strong Southern country. If we allow Zimbabwe to fall, next time it will be South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
It could be Mozambique. It could be Angola. It could be Namibia. This liberation government in that region, they will then transfer it to any African country. So we must stick together and fight this together, fight in the same trenches together.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I keep saying that Zimbabwe has been very fortunate because the geography has put it in that region of Africa where we have some strong leaders. If it had happened in West Africa, where all our leaders have no spine at all, President Mugabe would be out of power by now. But it will happen in the SADC region.
Well, it's a great story, and people have got to go to the New African May issue and read Mr. Nkoma's interview with President Robert Mugabe. By the way, it's a very heartening interview, very interesting. Bafour Nkoma, and Nkoma, thank you very, very much. We look forward to talking to you again soon.
You're welcome, Phil.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
That was interesting, and I do recommend it. We will... we hope to be in touch now with Michael Parenti. We're rolling along today. This is... past our limit. We usually do two, but we are.
I was going to say three
and
do three. Today is
and
really pushing it. That's great.
Yeah, we don't have 60 minutes of staff, you know, not full time. You're listening to Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and you can go to our website, taylor-report.com. Where some of the matters we're talking about, of course, you can hear the previous broadcast, but you can also, there are documents there touching on the matters we're treating today. Michael Parenti, whom we hope to speak to soon, is going to be speaking Sunday, May 20, at 55 Gould Street, G-O-U-L-D, that's at the Ryerson campus, at basically where CKLN is. And you can get tickets by going to a different book list. And get a lot of great things by going to the different book list, 746 Bathurst. And you can call for tickets at 416-979-5251, extension. I know you're writing this down. I'll slow down. 2373. And you ask for Daniel Vandervoort. And we have Michael Parenti on the line. Are you there, Ms. Parenti?
Yes, I am.
Hey, sorry we're a little late getting to you. I hope we didn't inconvenience you, but it... You're going to be coming to town Sunday, and the title of your talk, I don't know if you know this, but it is Race, Gender, and Class. And I want to know,
the title was supposed to be Race, Gender, and Class Power.
Oh, good. Well, that's a more optimistic way of looking at it. Power is a big part of what you're talking about when you talk about this matter. I have your book here, The Culture Struggle. I hope people will get that. I assume it'll be available there, but... you don't separate that subject of power from any of these matters that you talk about, whether race, gender, class, and, of course, culture. Am I right?
That's right, yeah. That rather than seeing these things as mutually exclusive or even competitive with each other, as some people do, we really should be looking at how they interact and reinforce and how they serve as a function of each other.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, racism is used to reinforce the class power of those who rule them or whatever.
Mm-hmm. You don't lack for examples in American culture, and now here I'm now I've used the magic word. I expect the duck to drop down and give me $20, but it's interesting. There always seems to be a debate or a kind of a way that the debate is handled, and I want to ask you about a specific instance here, and I assume it's a lot on your mind, this the incident of the broadcaster named Imus, and he was totally... made a number of personal reprehensible racist remarks male chauvinist kind of remarks, but within 12 hours of everybody saying that's bad, we ended up talking about hip hop and how bad that was. What are your thoughts about how that debate so quickly got transformed by all the major media?
Well, what was pointed out is that some hip-hop used terms like ho and nigger and stuff like that at times, and it's considered cool when they do it. There is a movement now among African-American leaders and spokespersons to say this stuff should be dispensed with altogether. There should be no in-group double standard, there often is an attempt to take the racial slur labels that are ascribed to one's group and turn them around and just use them in a familiar way to diffuse them or to trivialize them they're so far outrageous that they become in. They're so far out that they become in. And of course, the response that people made is, how are we going to be able to demand that other people clean up their act if you don't clean up yours? So that's pretty much the response there. What I want to do, though, and I hope to do in the talk, is show how race and gender oppressions have been functional and have served the interests of those who own and control most of society. I mean, racism is a way, or even the gender discrimination, that when you can segment a certain part of your populace and marginalize them in a certain way so that they have no access to the normal job market, even because of discrimination, then they will work at the dirtiest and poorest paying jobs and for lower than standard salaries, because that's the only way they can achieve employability. But that also, and historically that's usually been women, immigrants, children, or discriminated ethnic minorities. And that lowers the floor on wages, and the lower I as a boss can keep those wages, the bigger are my profits. So there's that. And the other thing that racism does is it divides the populace against each other. It got in the United States, it got very hard in some places to organize people because of the racial differences and the black workers and white workers. That's changed over the years, the credit of the labor union movement that did make those changes.
Yeah, I guess
that became another thing.
Labor is sort of having to bite the bullet right now on the issue of treatment of course, migrant workers. I was going to say migrant. I guess this is the right word in a sense, but Latino or Mexican workers. There's been the labor movement sort of came to battle with itself a little bit over. Gee, are they going to, where should they come down on this question of representation of Mexican workers?
Yeah, because on one hand, you would like to organize those people, and they're doing very tough work, low wages. On the other hand, there is a lot of feeling that about immigrants is that they come in and they're you've made certain historic gains in the condition of labor, and they will come in and work for below scale, and low standard, substandard work conditions, and that undermines then your position.
Mm-hmm.
So immigration historically has in a sense served as a way of suppressing wages. It's also pretty hard in the U.S. The African Americans are often instructed or scolded or told that they've got to emulate the immigrant experience and learn to just roll up their sleeves and work hard and keep their nose to the grindstone. Well, I mean, African Americans in this country do some of the hardest, toughest, lowest paying service work already. They do.
Mm-hmm.
But in many instances, the white immigration groups have just moved in ahead of them on the line. So rather than emulating their experience, they've been victimized by it in a way. And that's something that's often not discussed.
Yeah, I wonder, has it occurred to very many people to notice that the biggest May Day demonstration in the history of the country happened when those so-called illegals took to the streets? What a phenomenon.
Right. Yeah, those so-called illiterate, apolitical, not very informed people suddenly came out in this incredible militancy, immigration also can benefit a society. It does create problems. It does have its difficulty, but you're bringing in people who are not in their dependent years where the society has to feed and support them, but they're in their working years. You already have an advantage in the sense that the country that sends these people out is the one that has really paid the cost on raising and feeding them through their childhood and youth. You get also, this is both true for Canada and the U.S., we enjoy the brain drain, we get immigrants from all sorts of countries, and those are let in, if the guy's a brain surgeon or a doctor physicist or highly skilled in some area, then that's a different story.
We're speaking to Michael Parenti. He's coming to Toronto May 20, Sunday, 7 o'clock at 55 Gould Street. And you can go to a different book list, 746 Bathurst, and pick up tickets at a reduced price if you get there prior to Sunday, I guess, if you pick them up. Mr. Parenti has written a great new book, The Culture Struggle. In this, you
Hello?
Have a... Pardon me?
Hello.
Oh, I just wanted to cite something from your book and get you to expand on it. Mentioned the...
Hello, Phil. I don't know if you can hear me, but you've just gone dead.
You can't hear me?
I'm going to hang up.
Oh, he's going to hang up. Well, I don't blame him if he can't hear me. I'm going to read what I was going to read to him, and we can try to get him back in the meantime. In this book, Culture... I get the title right, Culture Struggle. Michael writes, ethnic conflict is not an inevitable or dominant human proclivity, but it exists as a powerful force and regrettably is still very much with us. Recall the song from Rodgers and Hammerstein Broadway musical, South Pacific. And the words are, you got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught from year to year. It's got to be drummed in your dear little ear. You've got to be carefully taught. And then, those are the words from South Pacific. And then Michael Parenti writes, and I think he might be with us. Are you there, Michael?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, I'm sorry about that.
What happened there?
I'm quoting you at the moment. And I've quoted you the portion from South Pacific, and where you go on to say what I'm suggesting is just the contrary. You've got to be carefully taught not to hate and fear. Could you talk about that?
It's just that we find studies show that children at a certain age become keenly aware of people's physical differences or things that seem out of the ordinary. or disabilities or things like that, and they will sometimes act differently, especially in a society where there's so much prejudice already. So really what we have to consciously do is remind children that, you know, that those differences are very superficial and not really human differences as such. I mean, that's nothing that great. And that even if other people are different, they should be accepted and not be eschewed or avoided.
Mm-hmm. And that's, of course, part of the thesis of the struggle aspect of that title. In other words, if I'm understanding, they have to be active. You can't just assume that, well, kids are going to be all right. They go out and play together. They're all going to just, you know, then they'll evolve nicely and everything will. But you actually have to say there's a kind of an agenda about developing. Is that right? I mean, in other words,
that's right, yeah. And, well, the book, the thesis of the book is that culture is not just a passive, traditional accretion of practices and values and norms. And it's not a neutral thing. The cultures are very loaded things. They will contain all sorts of practices that can be harmful to certain portions of our population and privileging all sorts of other select groups. And this is true of many cultures, and so we should be free to criticize them, including our own culture. And the question comes up, well, how do you criticize a culture when you're immersed in it, or when your standards of criticism and your values are themselves culturally determined? Well, I think the answer is that while culture permeates all our experience, it's not the sum total of human experience. We do know there are basic human rights that transcend cultures. So a starving child is a starving child in any culture, or a racist denigration of consigning one group to some kind of pariah status is something we've seen happen all over the world for different kinds of reasons. You know, in India it's a caste system or this or that, but we get the dynamic of it, and we are familiar, we see it as something familiar, and it's not something to be adored. There are those people who say, oh, you know, we must accept my culture. Don't you dare criticize my culture. Well, I'm sorry, if you stone to death a woman on suspicion of adultery, I'm going to raise a criticism about that and say, hey, that, I don't think that's the way human beings should behave anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. By the way, how about that broad word itself, the way it's used? I hate to stigmatize the U.S., but it seems to talk about culture is not a popular. It's very hard to reach. Let's put it this way: lots of people on this issue, isn't it? Is it not? I mean, that it's almost like Franco's general who said, "When I hear the word culture, I reach for my gun." There's a lot of people think that this is definitely off limits kind of subject.
Yeah, you know, that's a marvelous good quote, and I don't think I used it in the book. I wish I had, because I remember thinking about that quote when I was writing the book. In a way, actually, I think there's a lot of talk about culture here in the States. I mean, we even have in various universities culture study programs. You know, where you study culture. It's a study, anthropology. The anthropologists certainly deal with culture quite a bit, and popular culture is talked. There should be more criticisms of it, and it should be looked at from a more critical perspective, because the condition of American U.S. television is just terrible. I mean, it's just gone from bad to worse, and it's reaching an idiot level. As a culture critic, I'm supposed to watch that stuff, but I killed my television set months ago, and I'm much the better for it.
Well, by the way, as you point out, with the interrelatedness, you can pick it up anyway, right? You know who everybody's talking about, whether or not this movie star has done something, is going to run for governor. I mean, you find all that stuff out anyhow, right? I mean,
I
kind of feel like I've been watching TV shows, which I haven't been watching.
You know? Yeah, you're absolutely right. I know Anna Nicole Smith. I don't think I saw 3 minutes of her, but I sure heard a lot about it. And then I was watching serious news shows, and they were putting stuff on about her. Aside from that, the other thing, besides the trivialization and the transformation into junk of a culture, is the commodification of culture. That culture becomes a commodity more and more. In the old days, in the earlier societies, people created their own culture. They created their own songs. They created.
That's a quick question I got to get in before we end it. What happened? The labor movement used to have songs, and people used to get together.
Yeah, there used to be a labor culture. That's right.
Yeah.
Camps and night schools for workers and this and that and the other thing. And much of that is gone. Some of it still exists. The United Auto Workers still has a summer camp thing, but not much. With the advent of TV, people are now being cooked by this electronic commodified culture.
Well, I think of you as a circuit rider for the progressive ideas, and we're sure glad you're going to come and stop at Toronto. The book, The Culture Struggles, is terrific. We look forward to seeing you when you come.
All right. Thank you very much, Bill.
Michael Perini, thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And it's the Taylor Report, and we have a few moments to go. I want to thank Alex, Phil Conlon. Remind you, Michael Prendy speaking, 55 Gould Street, 7 p.m. Sunday. And you can get tickets at a different book list, 746 Bathurst. And I think for the Taylor Report, that's going to do it. Thanks very much. Be with you next week.